Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 675, Interview with Lucy Commissar, No Such Thing as a Free Lunch. This program is being recorded on May 31st of the year 2009. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves investigative reporter Lucy Commissar. Lucy, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Before we resume where we were with the topic that we were speaking of toward the end of Side 1, I'd like to clarify a couple of points and have you define a couple of things for us, particularly for the benefit of members of the listening audience that are not as familiar with business practices, legitimate or otherwise. First, a term. You made a reference to one of the people who could not keep up with the kickback scheme as operating on a low margin. Could you clarify what that means for us, what that term means?
Well, it means the profits that he can make or she can make from the money, that the revenue that comes in. So sometimes it may cost you $100 to make something and you sell it for $200. So that's a pretty good profit margin. You're getting 100% over the cost, but some things are very competitive and maybe you can only make 10% or 20% on your cost. So if this case, Sodexo, demands a kickback of 10%, that really eats into your profit margin, and it may hardly be worthwhile running the company.
All righty. We were talking about kickbacks. Are you in a position to sort of give us a general definition or operational paradigm of what a kickback is? How does it work? For the benefit of those people in the audience who are legitimate business people and might not be engaged in something like that.
Well, a kickback is, if you want my business, I'm going to pay you, you're selling me something.
Right.
And I'm going to pay you $100, but I want you to kick back $10 to me. But you can call it something else. You can say it's a volume discount allowance. That means if I buy 10,000 cartons of something, I am getting a discount based on the volume, and you're giving me back that much money, and you're calling it a volume discount allowance. But what happens is that this really is an enforced kickback. It's required of everybody, including the companies that are small enough, so there really isn't that kind of a volume. But beyond that, these savings were not passed on to the buyers, to the clients of Sodexo. Sodexo was running cafeterias. It was telling the hospital or the university or the school, this is how much the food costs. And you are paying us a fee based on the cost of the food, usually a percentage based on the cost of the food. And it's not telling those clients, by the way, the actual cost of the food is 10% less because we got the volume discount allowance, VDAs they call them. They just weren't telling them. Later they said to some people, well, we're getting our purchases on a national level. If we buy Pepsi-Cola, we're buying it for all of our clients, and we cannot figure out how to figure out how much would be going to you. That's totally untrue, because they have very complex computerized systems, so they know exactly how much of Pepsi-Cola or anything else is going to each client, and not only that, they know exactly how much of the kickback, which they call the volume discount allowance, is assigned to that particular client. But they have denied that because they want to keep getting the percentage based on the phony price, the price before the kickback.
Also, Lucy, you made a brief reference to Barack and Michelle Obama attending Joe Turner's Come and Gone. Now, was that the sort of date night that just took place last night in New York City?
It is.
Yeah,
and
okay.
Before they went on their date, they went to a restaurant that specializes in using produce from the owner's own farm, locally grown. And one of the reasons that Michelle Obama chose it is because she has been promoting the use of locally grown produce.
Yeah, because I noted there was perhaps predictable criticism by the RNC of Obama's taking an evening of recreation. Perhaps if Barack had gone down to a ranch and cleared brush for a weekend or two, that might have sat better with them. But Lucy, you were talking about the Pentagon, and they have been investigating some shenanigans vis-a-vis cafeterias. Why don't you recap and proceed with that point? We were talking about this at the end of Side 1.
Yeah, they found also the overcharging on their outsourced food services. And so they, when they called for bids last May, a year ago, they said there was a major change. They called it, quote, a major change in the bidding procedures. The contractors, such as Sodexo or its competitors, would have to identify rebates that they were pocketing. And if they passed on such rebates to other clients, and that might be now the schools, which have to get them back, they would have to give the same deal to the Pentagon. So this could lead to some changes there, and maybe there will be some awareness by businesses, by hospitals, that they are also being hurt and paying more because of these pocketed kickbacks.
If it's costing the Pentagon, of course, sooner or later it's costing us, both in terms of our tax dollars directly and undermining the ability of men and women in uniform to do their tasks.
And the one of the terrible things in this case is that the two brothers, John and Jay Carciero, have been harassed and treated terribly by Sodexo. They were fired. They have been forced. Now they have gotten lawyers now to fight their firing. They have a lot of documentation that they gave me that shows exactly what Sodexo is doing, and these are speeches and they are newsletters that are put out by the company themselves. And one of them, for example, the bulletin told managers to avoid cheaper products in favor of those that produce rebates. This was in the Sodexo Bulletin of March 22, 2004. It said, it was written by a man named Bob Sulik, who was director of procurement. He said, a manager told me today how he saves money by buying cans of tomato products from his fruit and produce vendor. That would be the local vendor. Please don't let this happen. People should buy the compliant products through their prime vendor. Compliant is code word for sending kickbacks. He said that's where the highest return is. There were many documents just like that that the brothers have and which they have given to law enforcement and which are part of their lawsuit and which they are given to me. Jay Carciero told me, when you go into a unit, that is, the company has on site in the hospital, has an office, has set up staff. He said, you're given a computer. When you need to order food or supplies, you order through a portal controlled by the company. If you want to use the farm down the street selling green beans, you couldn't do it without special approvals and lots of headaches. And there are many more on my website, thecommissarscoop.com. I have the full article where you can read many more examples of how Sodexo internally was telling the staff, you have to do what will bring us more money in kickbacks, which they called volume discount allowances, and don't buy from the local vendor because we're not going to make as much money that way.
By the way, the Carciero's last name is spelled Carciero, for those who might want to do an internet search or pursue that still further.
Yes.
Lucy, we've been obviously, you've been investigating for quite some time, and we've been speaking over quite some time offshore, not necessarily physically offshore, but why don't you define the term for us, and then let's talk about Julius Baer and how that exemplifies what we've been discussing.
Offshore is a place, and it started out being Little Island, but you can see it the same thing in Liechtenstein or Luxembourg. It's a jurisdiction that allows individuals and companies to set up secret bank accounts, secret companies, so outsiders cannot know who owns them. Generally, they don't pay any taxes, or they pay very low taxes. And the rule is that they will do this for you, set up a company and the account, as long as you are not doing business in that jurisdiction. So it's clearly just for outsiders to hide their money from the authorities of the countries where they really are. And they often do this for tax evasion. And that's the case that I wrote about, which is involves the subsidiaries of Julius Baer, which is one of the world's largest private banking and private banking organizations. It's based in Switzerland. It was using a Cayman Islands company to move its profits so that it wouldn't pay taxes in the country where the profits were actually generated. And the case I looked at involved New York, a company called JBIM, which means Julius Baer Investment Management. And I talked to the guy in the Caymans who was responsible for doing this, and he told me openly just what they were doing. I asked him, why did Julius Baer Investment Management, which was a subsidiary of Julius Baer but based in New York, in Manhattan, why was it using a company in the Caymans? What it was using was a company which was also a Julius Baer company called BSM Baer Select Management, supposedly to do the management of the funds that the company in New York was in charge of. It had assigned the management functions to this Baer Select Management and would pay it for doing these functions. He said that generating the income where a company was actually based, you would pay much more taxes. Can I repeat that? He told me that if you generate, that's in quotes, because that what it means is that's where you say the income is generated, where you're actually based, you would pay much more taxes. That means if Julius Baer Investment Management says that it's making the money from the funds that it was running, the investment funds, in New York, it would have to pay taxes in New York and in the U.S. If it's paying this company called Baer Select Management to be a manager for it in the Caymans and pays it a big fee, it deducts that as a business expense. So its income is partly being generated in Grand Cayman. Well, what was this company really doing? Well, according to Max Obrist, who was the head of it, it was monitoring things. He said, we have to follow stocks, monitor investment policies, we monitor the risk reports we get, we're in contact with the auditors. Now let's look at what this really means. It means they're not really running the company. They're not making the decisions. They are monitoring what somebody else is really doing, and for that, they're being paid money. It was a fake. This man actually had other real jobs that he was doing, which are listed on the company's annual report, which you can find on their website. Now, the reason that I found out about this is, again, it was a whistleblower. Rudolf Elmer had been the chief operating officer of Julius Baer Bank and Trust Company in the Caymans. He got into a fight with the company, and he started blowing the whistle. He has his own website now, too. He gave me a lot of documents that showed how this company was in using a fake company in Grand Cayman so it would evade U.S. taxes. The company, by the way, Julius Baer Investment Management, is now called RTO Global Investors, and it announced last year that it is going to an initial public offering. That is, it wants to sell up to $1 billion of common stock on the New York Stock Exchange. The offering would be handled by Goldman Sachs and Merrill Lynch. It was postponed because of the financial crisis. But I'm very interested in knowing if they get to make an offering on the stock exchange, whether the institutions that should be investigating them are going to be interested in the fact that they haven't been paying their taxes. Now, according to Max Obrist, the deal ended 4 or 5 years ago because they didn't have the hedge funds that had been using this tax-evading system. However, in the U.S., there is no statute of limitations for tax fraud, so they would still owe this money. And this is a very big company. The last I looked, although we don't know where the numbers are now, RDO Global Investors manages $72 billion in assets. It has about 900 institutional clients and over 700,000 mutual fund shareholders. This is a very big company. And the people who ran it in New York were paying themselves very, very well. In the first 9 months of 2007, the chief executive and the chief investment officer paid themselves $120 million. The company's income was listed after that as about $48 million. And we don't know what it might have been if they had included the money that they were paying offshore to the Caymans. But this was something that was also done to cheat the UK of taxes.
Just one sec, Lucy. Let me interrupt for a second. Now, the executives paid themselves $120 million?
Yes.
And the company's overall profit was listed as $48
million? After they paid themselves, the rest of it was $48.6 million.
Well, that may not be a free lunch, but it sounds pretty good. I just want to make sure I had those numbers right. Okay, excuse me. Go ahead. Forgive me for interrupting. Go ahead.
And I wanted to say that according to Rudolf Elmer, this tax evasion, he said this was a strategic plan adopted in 1996 to use Bear Select Management for the subsidiaries in New York and London to benefit from the offshore system, to transfer profits to those companies. And then from Cayman, they transferred profits through several other offshore companies until it got back to the Julius Baer Holding Company in Zurich. This is interesting because we have the documentation and we have the insider saying how it happened. But this is standard. This is endemic. Why are there 18,000 companies in one building in Grand Cayman? They're just paper companies. Obama has talked about these 18,000 companies. We know that this fund is doing it, but I would bet all the funds, or maybe two or three are not, but virtually all the funds are doing the same thing. They are cheating on their taxes by using fake shell companies to launder their profits, to move their profits offshore.
Of course, for decades now, really, much of the business community has always inveighed against taxes and claiming that if profits are taxed past a point, it's bad for business. It'll restrict commerce and hurt everybody, and it'll trickle down to Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, so to speak. It's interesting to observe what is actually taking place on the international financial landscape, because it sounds like, despite the fact, obviously, that the tax code in this country has been revised, at least over the last several decades, in favor of those interests who've been crying so loudly for the lowering of taxes on capital gains, corporations, and so forth, at the very time, during the very same period in which they've been doing that, they've obviously been taking the money and running offshore and implementing their own agenda regardless of what takes place in D.C.
Of course, that's correct. Two-thirds of the hedge funds are offshore. There's a reason for that. The people aren't offshore. They're sitting in Greenwich, Connecticut, or places like that. But the paper company is offshore in places like Uglan House in Grand Cayman. It's fake. And till now, it's been accepted by the U.S. government. If the Stop Tax Haven Abuse Act gets passed, there will be some tougher actions from the government. But we already have people like Senator Baucus, who is opposing this and trying to put in a stop tax haven light, we could call it, trying to
gut the legislation?
Yes, he's put in his own legislation to try and reduce the impact of the legislation that Senator Carl Levin has introduced, and which Obama says he supports. Be very interesting to see what happens now, because Baucus is in the committee that deals with this. Levin is not. Let's just see what happens. I think Baucus is carrying the water for the companies that want to cheat on taxes. He knows that there has to be some legislation. Obama promised it in his campaign. So what he's doing is trying to get a much weaker bill, to get support for a much weaker bill. So a lot of people can say, oh, yes, we voted for legislation against tax havens. But what they really are trying to do is kill the Stop Tax Haven Abuse Act, which is the strong bill.
So basically they're trying to set up something of a Potemkin village vis-a-vis legislating against offshore, appearing to do work against offshore while actually basically just going through the motions.
Yeah. Well, specifically, they may have some pieces of in that legislation that are valid, but it just waters down the bill that is necessary.
Perhaps we could call them the Baucus Caucus under the circumstances.
Yeah.
Lucy, another term that I'd like to ask you to clarify for us. And again, if this seems a little, if this seems stupid to you, accept my apologies. But hedge funds. Can you explain to the audience what is a hedge fund? How does it work? And for my part too, can you effectively distinguish between a hedge fund and a mutual fund?
Hedge funds are for the very rich, and they're pretty much unregulated. They go outside the country partly for that, though there are some that are not offshore companies, but they basically have gotten themselves out from regulation. And their argument is, we take money only from the super rich, and they know what they're doing. So we don't need regulation, because that's just for the small guys who don't know what they're doing. They have to be protected. The way they work is, the people that run them get a percentage of the amount of money they have invested for their clients, plus a percentage of whatever profits they make. But they put it through it's hokum. It's Barnum and Bailey hokum. They call the money they get not income, which they'd have to pay regular income taxes. They call it something else. There was a fight about this, because they own these hedge funds. There was a fight that they were just paying 15% on their profits, when really everybody else that makes that kind of money, they make billions. There are some of them that make actually more than $1 billion a year, and they're just paying 15%. But that the hedge funds are located offshore. They are set up so that they can evade taxes altogether. Nobody really knows who's investing what. They're set up. A third of them are in Grand Cayman. A third of them are in other offshore locations. And they do a lot of the very big buying of stocks. They are very big in short selling and naked short selling. The hedge funds are the major institutional short sellers and naked short sellers. Nobody knows what they're doing. They're not regulated. They're offshore. And they are the people who many people believe they brought down Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns.
Interesting. And how would that be distinguished from a mutual fund?
Well, those take anybody, really. You could buy some of the shares in a mutual fund, and so could I. And they are much more heavily regulated, because the clients are smaller people who may not really know everything that they should know about the investments. The hedge funds are the mutual funds, really, for the very, very big investors.
All righty. Lucy, you wrote an article late last year about the Vatican, of all institutions, has issued a pronouncement against offshore and indicating that in order to restore the world economy to a better state of health, something has to be done about this. I wonder if you could, we're almost out of time here, we have to encapsulate this. Tell us about that and then just briefly cite for us, because in the past you've talked about Banco Ambrosiano and their use of the Clearstream network, and they actually, Vatican-related interests, have availed themselves of offshore.
That's right. This was done just before the UN Conference on Finance and Development in Doha last November. And the Papal Council for Justice and Peace had been looking into this issue. They had been working with John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. He is based in London. TJN is a global organization. And they came to the conclusion that the financial crisis was exacerbated by the offshore financial system. And their statement, which was endorsed by the Vatican Secretariat of State, which speaks for the Pope on foreign affairs, they said the offshore markets, they called the offshore markets, quote, an important link both in the transmission of the present financial crisis as well as in maintaining a host of mad economic and financial practices. Among those practices, it said, were the movement of money to evade taxes and recycle profits from illegal activities and also gigantic capital flight. It's the first time that the Vatican has made such a statement. And according to Dr. Flaminia Giovanelli of the Papal Council in Rome, she told me the council had been studying the problem of financing for development. And she said the statement talked about tax havens because the council's study connected the fact that many companies don't pay taxes to financing for development and the financial crisis. The statement was published in Osservatore Romano, the Vatican newspaper. And Dr. Giovanelli said there were positive reactions from Catholic development organizations around the world. So it's really a groundbreaking statement, and perhaps we will see more from the Vatican and other organizations of the world's religions on this issue.
And, of course, in the past, specifically in an article that you wrote for In These Times a number of years ago called Explosive Revelations, you talked about how the Vatican Bank and people associated with the P2 Lodge and the Banco Ambrosiano were deeply involved in the use of the Clearstream network and engaging in some of the very shenanigans that now, thankfully, the Vatican is beginning to warn us against.
That is true, and probably there are different people involved in the Papal Council for Justice and Peace, if you just even consider the name, than the people that had been involved in the Vatican Bank. The Vatican has always been a place where there are conflicting forces, and in this case, this force seems to have won out on this issue.
Fantastic. Lucy, we are almost out of time. Tell people in the audience where they can find out more, because I'm sure they're going to be interested in finding out more.
Yes, I've written on all these subjects in articles that are posted to thecommissarscoop.com.
Thecommissarscoop.com. And I also want to mention to listeners www.spitfirelist.com. That's my website. And all of the various interviews that Lucy and I have done over the years, and also some other programs I've done highlighting Lucy's work, are available for download for free on that website. And there are also long written descriptions about these broadcasts as well. Well, Lucy, once again, it has been a pleasure to have you on our airwaves. And once again, I think you've helped to shed light on some of the darker corners of the corridors of financial and economic power.
It's been my pleasure to, as usual, it's been my pleasure to talk with you.
All righty. Well, Lucy, thank you so much, and we'll resume the effort whenever you see fit to download some more information for us. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 675, Interview with Lucy Commissar, No Such Thing as a Free Lunch. This program is being recorded on May 31st of the year 2009. For Lucy Commissar, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.